Hello and welcome back to the West Photo Podcast, produced from the West Photo office in the University of Westminster's School of Arts. My name is Luke Harlock, and in this episode we have Daphna Talmore. Daphna's chosen topic was an exhibition by Masahisa Fukase, Private Scenes, that she saw during FOAM in Amsterdam in 2017, which incidentally links to the book Ravens Michelle Henning mentioned by the same artist last episode. Daphna is an artist and lecturer based in London whose practice encompasses photography, video, curation, and collaborations. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy the podcast. So today we've got Daphna Talmore in. She's a photographic artist, deals with landscape, but also ways of subverting traditional landscape photographs. And so, yeah, I'd like you to start with just telling us a bit about how you came into photography, what your practice kind of involves, and where you are at the moment. Okay. Yeah, if you just want to take it away.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me. So how did I come into photography? It was quite a long-winded process to get there. I actually started out by studying art, fine art. I did 1 year of art school in Israel, which is where I was born. And from there, that 1 year was kind of more like a foundation year where I chose different mediums. I did a bit of sculpture, a bit of painting, art history, photography, printmaking. And then after that, I moved to London. I applied to Goldsmiths and I got in. And that was, again, an interdisciplinary course. So for 3 years, I was basically able to choose whatever medium I wanted. But somehow I kept returning to the camera and to photography. And I was just thinking more about why and, you know, like what it was about the camera as a transportable object that I could take with me to different places, which seemed to work really well, or kind of aligned itself with the fact that I was born in Israel, but I grew up in Venezuela, and I went to an international school there. So there's kind of quite, you know, migratory, transnational experience. So I felt like the camera kind of allowed me to deal with moving between these different places and spaces quite nicely. And so went on to do my MA at the Royal College of Art, which I finished in 2004. And so as well as using photography, I have also worked in video and collaboratively on different projects. But somehow photography has always been the main medium that I use. It's the one I feel like most compelled by or keep returning to.
Okay, brilliant. Do you want to tell us a bit about your sort of current project you've got at the moment and how you feel it's going forward?
Sure. So while I was a BA student and an MA student, so I was shooting primarily in interior spaces. I was doing a series of self-portraits called Obstructed Views, and I was really interested in the relationship between the figure and the space, the kind of like inside and outside. Windows were a recurring motif, and they were kind of like at the, I would say, the kind of protagonists of the image. I was thinking a lot about the photographic frame and like this kind of suggestion of another dimension beyond the frame and like all of the limitations of the medium in terms of representing reality and the kind of slippery relationship between photography and truth. So all of these things were kind of, you know, there on my mind. And somehow, alongside, like, making that work, I was also shooting images of landscapes when I was moving between these different locations, so Israel, where I was born, and Venezuela, where I was raised, and the UK, where I've lived for 20 years, and the States, where my sisters lived for a long time. So it was just, I guess I just started to think more about like why I had this compulsion to photograph in these different places, but without really having a kind of concrete idea or or a conceptually like considered way of thinking about landscape. And so after a number of years of doing that, I just found myself getting quite frustrated by the accumulation of negatives because they were all shot on film, and this kind of archive that I seemed to be building, which had a personal, you know, it was like a personal significance, but conceptually kind of fell flat. And just like the challenge of using those images in a way that made them, I felt like somehow I felt were giving me the space to comment on my relationship to landscape generally, but also more historically to representations of landscape throughout the history of photography up until, you know, the contemporary discourse around the analog and digital divide and representations of landscape in its widest sense. So that's where the project was born. The project is called Constructed Landscapes. And basically it involves reconfiguring, collaging, layering these negatives and cutting out anything that is very obviously man-made from the negative. That tends to be the starting point. And the reason I started to do it, or like started out by cutting or removing these elements, is because there were several reasons. One being that I felt they were interrupting the landscape in some way, and I was quite interested in these interruptions. And then I was also interested in how these very obviously man-made elements or structures seem to invite a particular kind of narrative. You know, if you think about roads and paths, like, they're so kind of heavily symbolic, aren't they? And so you immediately start to think of some kind of journey or experience. So I felt that, you know, they were kind of quite disruptive in that sense. And what I was hoping or aiming to do is to somehow empty these locations or places of the personal significance on the one hand that they held, and on the other, all of the kind of connotations or associations that tend to come with specific locations, whether they're political or, you know, sociological. And so that kind of removal was an attempt to contend with those kind of quite loaded connotations. But then what became interesting to me, paradoxically, is that obviously by trying to remove these so-called interruptions, I was creating a new interruption, which was also man-made. So basically the whole project kind of contends with or tries to deal with different questions around representations of landscape, but trying to empty spaces of specificity, but at the same time, like, kind of acknowledging how, on some level, that's an aspiration and is quite impossible in some way.
Mm. And I was thinking during your talk, what you think about maybe an idea of censorship. Do you feel like you are censoring them, or do you think you're highlighting the bits that you're leaving? Do you feel, what do you think about censorship?
Interesting. I've never thought about it as censorship. That's really, really fascinating. I mean, I am, you know, I think a lot about obstruction. So, and I guess obstruction is a form of censorship because I am withholding visual information. I think as a metaphor, that's really interesting. I think in terms of photography as a medium, in terms of thinking about the photographic frame, there's always something that is left out. I mean, that it's such a limited thing, isn't it? In terms of where you point, if you are using a camera even, where you point your camera. So in my case, like, what I choose to shoot and what I don't, and then what I choose to kind of leave in, what I remove. But again, like, if you think about photography more generally, then so much of photography is about, like, absence and presence and how that gets played out. And again, like, thinking about the frame as something that, you know, points to so much that sits outside of it, whether it's, like, in relation to the history of photography or, like, other kind of forms of image making, pictorial conventions, and so yeah, I feel like it's quite a complex thing, and so I'd never thought about it in terms of censorship, but I'll certainly think about that more.
Because I saw the kind of black void, they do remind me of sort of what is left, but then as they it's kind of the absence of a negative, it's not like you're going over something.
Well, it varies, because there's because the first part, the series is made up of two sub-series, so the first part, the blackboard, is actually covering, because there's only one layer of negative, because it's made up of two negatives, and so there's where it's the black void is where there's only one. So in a sense, that's a very conscious decision that I made. I could have, like, you know, in the dark room, I could have chosen to dodge that area, and then you would have seen the landscape that's sitting beneath it. But but when I was printing and I got that overexposure and that kind of black void, I thought that was much more interesting, again, in terms of the metaphor of, you know, what it might be concealing, and how, again, you know, it leaves, hopefully it leaves more space for people to, and raise questions around what that obstruction might be pointing to, whether it's visually, physically, or metaphorically. Whereas in the second, the more recent part of the work, the black voids are actual empty spaces where the paper has been burnt and overexposed. So conceptually, they're, on some level, they're doing similar things, but then at the core of it, I think it's quite different.
Yeah. Okay, I think it's interesting how you sort of got the impression that you seem to see the cutting out as, I guess, an extension of, like you were saying, every photographer leaves out what they think, and let's say they're taking a picture of a corner of a street, they'll maybe not include a lamppost that would be sort of half in frame, so they'll move it along a bit. And it's interesting how you've taken that to sort of an extreme of not being constrained by the square of the sensor or the film, or
I mean, I think it's really what is at the core of that is, in terms of my practice, is to think again about the photograph as being a construct no matter what. So it's, as you say, it's just like pushing it, like, you know, much further than like it actually already is. It's reiterating it. And I think it's also about, like, you know, that manual intervention is quite important, also in contrast to the very kind of mechanical nature of photography. So it's about, so I think, you know, what I was again interested in was the kind of paradox of, you know, like, on the one hand, trying to kind of erase, or I guess censor, if I'm going to use your word, like censor that kind of manual or kind of human presence, but at the same time reassert it through the very kind of hands-on manipulation, and then think about that also in relation to the kind of manipulation that a lot of times gets disguised and is quite seamless and very slick in, you know, like when you think about digital manipulation.
I had a question about your interactions with the Arts Council and applying for funding. As you mentioned, you did that for a few of your exhibitions and appearances of your work. What can you say about the experience of applying?
Yeah, I mean, I've applied 5 times for the Grants for the Arts funding, and it took me a long time to actually get to a point where I felt it was the right moment to do so. And so in the talk I mentioned applying for funding for the first time for a group show at Photo Fusion, which is a photography centre in South London, where there were 4 of us that had been selected from their annual members show, and we got a small bursary and mentorship towards the exhibition. And so it just felt like the right moment. I'd been working on the Constructed Landscape series for... I started the series in 2009, but I really started to focus on it in 2012. So I'd been working on it for kind of quite in quite a concentrated way for about a year, and I felt like, you know, there was something there that that, you know, made sense in terms of asking for funding to kind of extend the work. And, you know, I had this very concrete thing, which was the group show at Photo Fusion, and there were other elements like a workshop that I was interested in running. So it just felt like the right time. And I think so much about applying for these opportunities is about figuring out when the right time is. And the other thing that was key was that I got a lot of support from Photo Fusion with the application process. There was also an Arts Council officer that came in as part of this professional development program that was being run at Photo Fusion called the London... The New Creatives Market Program. It was an EU-funded professional development scheme. And so the Arts Council officer came in and he was talking about how to apply and giving, you know, a lot of practical advice. So I felt like all of these things just came together and it just felt like the right moment. And so obviously beyond that, it's quite a labor-intensive thing to do. But I think it's really useful because even if you don't get the funding, it kind of basically encourages you to think about what you want to do, how you want to do it in a kind of ideal way. And then even if you don't get it, then you know, it gives you a kind of structure. Obviously, I was incredibly pleased that I did get the funding, and it meant that I could do things that I couldn't have done without it. So it kind of opens up the space to maybe experiment in a way that you wouldn't be able to do, print at a scale that you wouldn't be able to print at. So yeah, I highly encourage people to go for it. But it is time-consuming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you. I asked you to think a bit about what your favourite exhibition, piece of work, piece of writing is at the moment. And, yeah, so I was just wondering if you want to introduce what you've come up with.
Yeah, I mean, I always find that to be such a difficult question because there's so many brilliant artists, photographers, you know, filmmakers. I mean, that's the thing about... I feel in terms of the things that inspire me, it's not just looking at photography, it's like also literature, it's, you know, personal experience. So there's this really kind of wide range of things that I look at or listen to, podcasts actually as well. So it was quite difficult. But on the other hand, I was thinking to, you know, what I've seen recently that really kind of stayed with me or moved me. And there was this exhibition at FOAM in Amsterdam that I saw while I was there for Unseen in September. And it was the work of a Japanese photographer called Masahisa Fukase. And I'd seen a bit of his work before and I was aware of it, but I hadn't seen the extent of his practice that was shown. It's like, it's a small retrospective. And he was working from the kind of from the 60s to the early 90s, and he had such an incredibly wide range of practices, and I just thought there was something about the way that he experimented with photography, with, you know, different materials, different processes, different genres. You know, there's everything from family portraiture and a very playful kind of subversion of that in the series of images that he took. Then there's self-portraits, there's like multiple exposures, there's images that are combined with pins, you know, so there were all these like interventions or tampering with the images. And there's like also something that is incredibly personal about his approach, but somehow like goes beyond the personal, becomes incredibly, or feels much more universal. So I felt like, you know, his work was functioning on so many different levels, and also just in terms of how the show was curated and presented also was incredibly, I felt, just worked really well. So it's something that stayed with me, and just was challenging and thought-provoking in all of the ways that, you know, good work should be.
Yeah, brilliant. So do you feel like it has inspired you to incorporate more experimentation in your practice? Because I know your practice is very experimental anyway. And, I don't know, how do you feel it will influence your practice?
Yeah, I think it's always, like, I feel like all these things kind of filter through, but I don't really think about, when I look at other people's work or I read something, it's not like there's this very direct kind of correlation, or, you know, it could be something that filters through years later and all of a sudden kind of makes sense, you know, when you look back and you think, oh, actually, when I saw his work or that exhibition or I read that, something just comes together. I mean, I think also as someone who teaches regularly and talks a lot about, you know, other people's work and kind of, you know, think about research, then it's also, I tend to look at work in different ways. So, like, on the one hand, I'm thinking about it in relation to my own practice and how, I think also just how contemporary his work feels. But then on the other hand, I'm thinking about it or appreciating it from a kind of, a kind of educational perspective and how it might be relevant to students or to, like, the discourse around photography generally and art. And, yeah.
I did some research on his work of what I could find, because I haven't been to the exhibition. But do you think how Fukase, how he died and how sort of kind of tragic that is, sort of influences people's perception of his work? Or
That's an interesting question. I mean, I guess to a certain degree, probably, but I still think even if he hadn't, you know, because he basically experienced a really bad fall and had brain damage and was in a coma for 20 years before his death in 2012. So obviously that does, like, you know, there's something more loaded about the images because you think of, like, how tragic it was and how he was so prolific and made so much work, and you start to think or imagine what he might have produced had he not, like, experienced that fall. And so, yes, but on the other hand, I feel like his work is so powerful in itself and is charged in, like, you know, in all of these different ways. So it's like a yes and a no, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think it kind of adds? Or,
well, in the latest reissue of his, I think his most famous work, Raven, in the about section at the back of the book, after you've experienced all the images and after you've kind of felt the emotional weight of the series as a whole, they do mention sort of his kind of loneliness a lot, and how the end of his life sort of mirrored this work of the Ravens.
Yeah, kind of preempted it in a strange kind of way.
So, yeah, I feel sort of the publishers of that book, they seem to sort of give it a kind of potency because of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the context in which images are made, or also, like, you know, the kind of biographical facts of, you know, of the artist or, you know, the author, that all, inevitably, that's always going to have an impact in terms of how people look or experience the work. I wonder, but sometimes I feel like it also can sit outside of that, or it's interesting to try and separate, although I think that's quite challenging. So we are, like, I think it's quite easy to project, you know, when you know something about someone on a personal level, then inevitably when you look at the work, you start to read it in a particular way because of that context. So I think that's something that I'm also, like, constantly fascinated by in relation to images, in relation, let's say, to text. And when I say text, I don't mean it has to even necessarily be something that is physically there. It's more like you say, like this information that we have access to and that we know in relation to the work, in terms of like when it was produced, and then in terms of how it's experienced in, you know, in the present, and how that can shift quite dramatically as well.
Yeah, in the book I found that the text was at the back, so I did experience all the work beforehand. So I already formed my opinion of the work before reading the text, which I thought was quite kind of good move, because what they did say in the text was kind of reinforcing what I thought of the images when I was looking through, but then it also adds on it as well. Mm-hmm. So then you can kind of keep thinking on it rather than looking through the work and coming to your own conclusions. You then get a sort of another take on it as well. But I just wanted to ask, you mentioned in your talk you had some people write on mm-hmm. one of your exhibitions and made a small publication, so you invited different. I was wondering what if you want to speak about that, and maybe how you found sort of their text. Was it helpful for how you think of your work, kind of thing, or not? Sure.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's always really helpful and just a great experience when, you know, when you read text written by someone else about your own practice. And I think when I basically invited 5 writers and commissioned them to respond to the Constructed Landscape series or part of it, and that was in the context of a solo show at Photo Fusion in 2017. That was I applied to the Arts Council for that as well. And so what that enabled me to do was to commission these writers. And what I was quite interested in when I invited the 5 writers was that I didn't want to impose a particular kind of approach or angle. I was more interested in presenting them with the work and talking to them about the work, and then seeing like how they would respond. And it was just quite interesting that I invited 5 of them, and they consisted of Olga Smith, who's an art historian and an academic, and then Shoer Mevlian, who's a curator and now the director of PhotoWorks. She was working at the Tate Modern at the time. I invited Sarah Butler, who's primarily a novelist, and Gemma Padley, who writes widely on photography and art, and Miranda Gavin, who also is a writer and an artist herself. And so I was just very interested in how these different people would engage with the work and respond to it in a personal way. So what I ended up getting were 2 essays and 3 much more experimental responses that were more like poetry. And so, yeah, it was quite an interesting experiment to see how people choose to respond to work when you don't give them a set brief. And I was really pleased with the kind of the range of approaches. And I was also interested in making a publication that was purely text-based, so there are actually no images of the work at all. And so it became about like trying to bring in these different voices and their responses. And so then the way that the publication functioned was, you know, kind of function on one level when it was in the context of the show at Photo Fusion and you had the work that, you know, there around you. But then it became something quite different when you took the booklet away and you read the text and you didn't have the images. Obviously, you could then choose to, you know, look up the images online. So I felt I was quite interested because of what I was saying earlier about this, the relationship between text and image and how crucial it is in terms of how we experience images or how we project or, you know, like interpret them in relation to text. So that was something I was kind of playing with.
One final thing, I know you just did a talk as part of the Westminster Photo Forum series. You didn't get a chance to talk on, you were saying you wanted to speak more on collaboration.
Yeah.
As a topic, and I was just wondering if you wanted to do that on here as opposed to...
Yeah, I mean, I think collaboration is so important and invaluable in many different ways. and it's something that I really enjoy doing. And I feel like collaboration can take on so many different forms, whether it's inviting people, you know, like to respond to your work, or, you know, like more informally when you meet with other artists or your peers to talk about each other's work, whether you set up a space together. So the thing I was going to talk about was the studio that I set up 10 years ago with another artist and Royal College of Art graduate. So we were in the same year at the RCA, and her name is Lucy Levine. And so 10 years ago, we took on a space from Space Studios, and we set up our own color dark room. And we also have a small black and white dark room in the same space. And the reason that we set that up is because for us, like coming out of college and not having access, regular access and affordable access to a dark room was like quite inhibitive. And we felt that printing was a really important part of our practice. And so it just seemed to make sense that we should set up a space. And to be honest, we didn't think about it too much beyond that. Like, we didn't have some long-term plan. It happened quite organically. We spent a few years gathering equipment at the time. A lot of colleges were getting rid of their dark rooms, so getting rid of equipment. So we bought some, and then everything just kind of came together quite magically. When we finally decided it was time to set up the space, in the fact that Peter Fraser had a studio with a color darkroom in it, and it was in this building where we are now, and we just happened to see an ad on the space website advertising the space with photographers' fittings. And I won't go into the detail because it's a long story, but basically everything just kind of came together and felt a bit like it was just kind of meant to be. And so we moved into the space, which already had a processing machine and an enlarger, and we brought in the rest of the equipment and spent 2 months and invested some of our own money to like fit out the space and build some more cubicles. And then just assumed quite naively, I think, that because we wanted somewhere to print regularly, there'd be loads of people just like us that would be kind of queuing up to join us. And so, initially it was quite difficult. We had some members, but people were coming and going quite a lot. And then over the last 4 or 5 years, we've just seen this incredible, like, surge in, you know, in darkroom printing and alternative processes. And interestingly, a lot of our members, because that's how we run it, we have a membership scheme. We have, I always forget if it's 13 or 14 members that use the darkroom regularly. A lot of them work in fashion. And so that was something that we never kind of expected. I think because we came from a fine art background, I mean, Lucy also works in editorial and other things, but we just assumed it would be fine art photographers that would be using our space. And so that was quite an interesting shift, and just it's just different ways of working. And I think that's part of what we were interested in, is having this space that on the one hand gave people access to a space where they could experiment and make work, but then come together and work alongside each other in different ways. And I always credit the darkroom as being the reason why I ended up making the Constructed Landscape series. I really think that if I didn't have access to that space, I don't know if I would have experimented as much as I did, because I would have had to pay quite a lot to use darkrooms, and I would have maybe played it safe a bit more. So I think collaboration can, you know, has so many benefits. And then there's other collaborative initiatives that I've done in terms of curating, but I feel like maybe we'd be here for quite a long time.
Thank you very much to Daphne Talmore for speaking on this episode. You can find all our episodes with links to our guest websites online via iTunes if you just search for the West Photo Podcast. Thank you very much for listening.